Osho, The Perfect Master, Volume 1, Talks on Sufi Stories, Discourse Number 5, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
A Sufi teacher was visited by a number of people of various faiths who said to him, "Accept us as your disciples, for we see that there is no remaining truth in our religions, and we are certain that what you are teaching is the one true path." The Sufi said, "Have you not heard of the Mongol Halukhu Khan and his invasion of Syria? Let me tell you. The Vizier Ahmed of the Caliph Mustasim of Baghdad invited the Mongol to invade his master's domains. When Halukhu had won the battle for Baghdad, Ahmed went out to meet him to be rewarded. Halukhu said, 'Do you seek your recompense?' The vizier answered, 'Yes.' Halukhu told him, 'You have betrayed your own master to me, and yet you expect me to believe that you will be faithful to me.' He ordered that Ahmed should be hanged. Before you ask anyone to accept you, ask yourself whether it is not simply because you have not followed the path of your own teacher. If you are satisfied about this, then come and ask to become disciples."
What is man's basic problem? It is not ignorance. What is man's basic problem? It is not ignorance. It is knowledge. Knowledge is always borrowed. It is never original. But one can believe that one knows, can befool others, and can be befooled himself. Knowledge is the greatest deceptive force in the world. It makes people cunning, hypocrites, egoists. It gives them false notions that they know, what truth is, that they know what true path is. And because of this, they go on missing. They come across truth many times, but they cannot see. Their eyes are full of knowledge, hence blind. A knowledgeable man is a blind man. He is cunning and clever, but not intelligent. And cunningness and cleverness look like intelligence. But that is only an appearance, and don't be deceived by the appearance. Because it is there where man's basic confusion is rooted. His cleverness, his cunningness, his knowledgeability. One has to unlearn it all. Then only one becomes a disciple. If you know already, you can't be a disciple. Your very knowledge will hinder you. How can you surrender when you know? Knowledge never surrenders. It is only innocence that is capable of that great quantum leap. Surrender is possible only out of innocence, because out of innocence arises trust. Out of innocence is faith. Out of innocence is all religion. I have heard a beautiful anecdote. A great master, Jussieu, went to suffer the exile in Germany. He came to a city of reformed Jews. When they saw his ways, they mocked him and thought he was crazy. When he came into the synagogue, some of them poked fun at him, and when the children saw their parents ridiculing him, they thought he was crazy and began to pull at him and tug at his belt. Then he beckoned to the children and said, "My dear children, gather round and I will tell you something." The children thought he would show them a trick. They all stood around him, and he in the middle. And he said to them, "My dear children, look well at me. Do not take your eyes off me." The children, because they thought he was going to show them something, looked steadily at him, and he also looked steadily at each child separately. After that, he told them to go home. When the children came home and were given their food, they refused to eat. One said that the meat must not be eaten. Another asked how one could eat unclean meat. And so all the children refused to eat. They said the dishes were unclean and the food was unclean. Then, as women do, one went to another and told her that all of a sudden her son came home from the prayer house and refused to eat. Whatever was given to him, he said it was unclean. Then her neighbor said that her son too refused to eat and shouted that everything was unclean and that one could not pray in her house because her hair was uncovered. Then another neighbor came in and also told such things about her son. The whole town was amazed. Then they each learned that their sons were not only ones who suddenly became pious. They said that the visitor whom they had ridiculed and thought crazy was none other than a saint. By looking at the children, he had instilled in them something of his being. The parents became afraid that they had shamed him and went to beg his forgiveness. Jussieu laughed and forgave them all. He wanted to look in their eyes too, but they escaped as fast as they could. In this beautiful anecdote, what happened? The children were innocent. They were ready to look into the eyes of this strange master. They became connected. For a moment, they were lost into the vastness of the Master. For a moment, the Master flowed in them. There was a meeting and a merger, a communion. Just looking in their eyes for a few moments, something was transferred. The purity of the man. The holiness of the man. Something of his being is spilled into the eyes of the children. They were no more the same. Their vision changed. But the grown-ups escaped. they were afraid to look into the eyes of the master. What was their fear? They were cunning, clever, knowledgeable. They must have thought it is a kind of hypnosis or something. This man is a magician or something. They must have thought of thousand and one things. The time is not ripe for us. We cannot go on this faraway journey. The moment has not come. We will have to wait. We have to do thousand and one other things. Then they were not innocent. Even their apology was out of cunningness. It was not out of love and understanding. They were afraid. Maybe the man is so strange and powerful, he may do something wrong to them. Hence the apology. Not out of understanding, not out of humbleness, but out of fear. But the children, they simply are not in tune with the master. Jesus is right when he says, unless you are like small children, you will not enter into my kingdom of God. Jesus was standing in a marketplace. A crowd was standing around him. And somebody asked a rabbi, that you talk so much about the kingdom of God, but who will be capable enough, pure enough, virtuous enough, saintly enough to enter into your kingdom of God? What will be the characteristics of the people who will be allowed in? Jesus looked around. The rabbi thought he will say people like you. And the rich man of the town who has donated much to the synagogue and who has been a charitable man, thought he will say, man like you. And there was another who has practiced all that has been told down the ages, all rituals, prayers. He has followed every rule and regulation. He was a virtuous man, known as a saint. He thought, certainly, he is searching for me. He will say, man like you. But they were all frustrated. His eyes moved. He stopped on a small child who was just standing in the crowd. He took the child up. So to the people, that those who are like this small child, they will be able to enter into my kingdom of God. It is innocence that falls in harmony with the divine. Knowledge is a jarring note. Knowledge is a china wall. Knowledge is an armor, your defense against the mysterious. But that's what happens. People who are knowledgeable start searching for truth. And they have taken one thing for granted, that they already know what it is. Now it is only a question of searching. They will be able to recognize it. They know its characteristics. It is not so. Unless you know truth, there is no way to know it. No scripture can describe it. There is no possibility of anybody giving you the knowledge of truth. A master never gives knowledge of truth to you. He simply makes his truth available to you. If you are courageous, if you are innocent, if you are open, ready to take the jump, ready to die in the master, then you will know truth, but not knowledge about truth, but an experience of it. Truth always comes as an experience. It is always existential. Remember, these are the barriers. The man has followed all the rituals. Things he knows. He is a great yogi. He has not been missing a single rule of the yoga. He thinks now he is capable. He is not. It is not ritual that prepares you. Ritualistic people are stupid. I have heard they follow the ritual, but the ritual is followed unconsciously. And they will find ways and means how to go on following the ritual and yet remain the same. A doleful looking customer went to the bar and ordered 6 whiskies. The barman poured them out for him in 6 glasses. "Now line them up in front of me, will you?" asked the customer. He then paid for them and told him to keep the change. He swallowed down the contents of the first glass in line and then repeated the process with 3rd and 5th glasses. Then saying good night, he turned to walk away. "Excuse me," said the barman, "you have left 3 glasses untouched." "Yes, I know," he said. The doctor said he did not mind me taking the old drink. You can always find a way. The ritualistic person remains cunning. A politician who had been prevailed upon to accompany a friend on a beer hunt had concealed his nervousness manfully, although his first night in camp was a sleepless one. Starting forth in the morning, the two had walked but a short distance when they came upon fresh tracks, which the enthusiastic sportsman identified as being those of a large bear. "Tell you what we had better do," said the politician brightly. "You go ahead and see where he went, and I will go back and see where he came from." Remember that man is so cunning, so political, that he can always find a way out of a certain ritual, discipline. And he can remain untouched by it. And he can go on doing the ritual and yet remain untransformed by it. That's why you see so many people in the world going to the synagogue, to the church, to the temple, to the mosque, to the gurudwara, and still remaining the same. Millions of people are praying, but there seems to be no prayer in existence. There seems to be no fragrance of prayer in the world. There is but hatred and hatred. There seems to be no love. How is it possible that millions of people pray every day and there is no love flower? so many people pray and no compassion. Something must be deep down wrong, fundamentally wrong. The prayer is false. It is being done because it has to be done. It is a kind of duty to be fulfilled. But the heart is not in it. The cunning man always keeps his heart away from everything that he does. He only pretends. He goes through empty gestures. And he is so cunning that he can always find a loophole and escape from it. Basic problem of man is not ignorance, it is knowledge. Ignorance never makes a person cunning. So those who are really ready to become disciples, they have to drop only one thing, and that is their knowledge. They have to become ignorant again. And when you become consciously ignorant, ignorance becomes luminous. The whole point is of consciousness. You can remain unconsciously very knowledgeable, and your knowledge remains dark, dismal, dead. If you become consciously ignorant, even your ignorance becomes enlightened. It is luminous. It is full of light. And remember, when you consciously look at your life, you are bound to become ignorant again. Because knowledge as such is not possible. Life remains a mystery. There is no way to demystify it. That's what knowledge is trying to do. It is a demystification of life. It tries to destroy mystery. It makes everything clear, explained away. The whole effort of knowledge is how to banish mystery from existence. It cannot be banished. It is its ultimate nature. It is not an accidental quality. Mystery is the very core of life. Life is mysterious. They are synonymous. So the man of knowledge does not destroy the mystery of life. He simply closes his eyes with a very thick curtain of knowledge. And he starts thinking he knows. He knows nothing. It will look strange to you and very paradoxical, but it is so. The man who knows nothing. And the man who knows that he is ignorant has started knowing. The whole point is of consciousness. A conscious ignorance is what a disciplehood is. Conscious ignorance. But people are living in unconsciousness. And they go on groping. In unconsciousness they go to the masters, but in unconsciousness. They remain with the masters but fast asleep. Sooner or later they become fed up because nothing is happening. Nothing can happen if you remain unconscious. You cannot connect with the master. They remain cunning, clever, even when they are with the master. Nothing happens. Nothing can happen in knowledgeability. Sooner or later they decide that this is not the right master. Without ever thinking that am I the right disciple yet? That should be the basic question. It is none of your business who is the right master or not. And how can you decide? You don't know what a master is. You are not even a disciple yet. You have not taken even the first step, and you are thinking and deciding and judging about the last step. it is better to keep quiet. Just think about one thing again. Remind you again and again whether I am the right disciple, whether I am ready to learn. Have I dropped my knowledge? Have I come with an open heart? Am I trying to become more conscious of what I am doing? Is my prayer conscious? When I sit by the side of the Master, am I sitting there consciously, alert, aware? When I listen to the Master, am I really listening? Or just hearing? Hearing is one thing. Listening is very different. Hearing is simple. Anybody hears, whosoever has ears can hear. Listening is rare. When your ear and your heart are together, then listening happens. When you hear, your mind is full of thoughts. The turmoil continues, the traffic continues, all kinds of noises, thoughts, prejudices. Through that crowd, yes, you hear, but you can't listen. For listening, silence is needed. There should be no clouds inside you, no thought stirring. Just a pure silence, then listening happens. The disciple has to ask again and again, am I really a disciple? Am I yet a disciple? And if one remains alert about that, you will find many masters in life. But if you are not aware of it, you may come to a Buddha and will go empty-handed. Hank was riding the range, a singing and a humming. Suddenly his horse reared and stopped. In front of them was a huge snake. Hank drew his gun and was about to fire when the snake cried, "Don't shoot. If you spare my life, I have the power to grant you any three wishes you make." "Okay," said Hank, figuring he had nothing to lose. "My first wish is a handsome face like Paul Newman. Second, I want a muscular body like Muhammad Ali. And my last wish is to be equipped like my horse here." "Granted," said the snake. "When you wake up tomorrow, you will have all those things." Next morning, Hank awoke and rushed to the mirror. Sure enough, he had a face like Paul Newman, and to his delight, he saw a pair of massive shoulders and arms like Muhammad Ali. Then glancing down in great excitement, he let out a blood-curdling howl. "My God, I clean forgot," he babbled. "Yesterday I was riding Nelly." Man lives in unconsciousness, unaware. And you can be even with a Buddha, and nothing is going to happen to you. Your unconsciousness will be a mountain. The wives of a Buddha are very delicate. They cannot penetrate your mountains of unconsciousness. If you are conscious, then only those delicate wives can penetrate you. They are subtle. They are not violent. They are not aggressive. They will not even knock on your doors. They will not force entry into you. The wives of a Buddha cannot rape. They come very silently. If you are utterly quiet, only then you become aware of their presence. They come without any noise. Rose petals falling on the ground. Yes, just like that. But it is very easy to decide that the master is wrong. In fact, that helps you to remain the way you are. What can you do? The master is wrong. And then you go on moving from one master to another and hoping. But you remain the same. If you miss one master, you will miss all of them. In fact, the more you go from one master to another master, you are simply becoming more and more accustomed of missing. You are becoming habituated to it. You are learning how to miss. If you miss one, then to miss the other will be easier. And then to miss the third will be even more easier. And if you have been moving to many masters, slowly, you are so efficient in missing that it is almost certain that you will never find a master anywhere. That's why people can't find. Not that masters don't exist. A life is so rich. Existence always gives you all possibilities to grow. Masters are available. And always, in no time, in no country, it is that they are not available. In no clime. Howsoever the dark is the time on the earth, the masters are always available. In fact, the darker it is, the more possibility of masters being available. Krishna says, when it will be dark and the religion will be destroyed, I will come. I always come. So the moments of darkness, of miserable times, are the opportunities for masters to bloom. The physicians happen when people are ill. Nature always balances. It always provides your needs. Just watch. A woman becomes pregnant. And her whole body starts preparing for the child. By the time the child is born, suddenly her breasts are full of milk. The child is not born yet. But food is getting ready. Nature provides all that is needed, even for a child who has not even asked, who cannot ask. Before the child comes, the food has arrived. Before the hunger, the food. Before the thirst, the water. And before the disciple, the master. So if you are a disciple, you are bound to find a master. It has never been otherwise. If you cannot find a master, think again, meditate over whether you are a disciple. And you will find you are too full of knowledge. That's why you cannot be a disciple. A disciple means one who is ready to learn. And a man full of knowledge is not ready to learn. He is ready to teach. He is not ready to learn. Are you a disciple? A disciple is one who is ready to surrender, to bow down, to drop his head. Are you ready to die? Are you ready to stake all that you have? Nobody seems to be ready to die. In fact, people need a master not to die, but to live forever. They would like to become immortals. They would like to find the elixir that will make them immortals. They would like to find something so that they can fight with death. Yes, that is found. But you have to fulfill the condition first. And the condition is, only those who are ready to die will attain to life eternal. A very ancient story, a true story, and of great significance. In some monastery in Tibet, a monk who was thought to be dead was buried in a crypt. After a time, he regained consciousness, and horror and mental conflict set in. The crypt was opened only when a brother died, and it was impossible to call loud enough or to knock hard enough to be heard. What then was the unfortunate man to do? Was he to wait for a death of starvation and thirst? There in the neighborhood of his dead brother, he began to pray, but was not prayer a supplication that God might grant death to one of his healthy brother? Because the crypt will be opened only when somebody dies in the monastery again. That is the only possibility for him to get out, if somebody dies immediately. Against such horrible mental and physical agonies, you can well complete the picture. Our dear monk held out and remained alive. He kept himself alive by eating insects which fell down into the crypt through a small air hole. And he licked the drops of moisture from the walls. Dirty sewage water. After many years, they found the unfortunate man wrapped in cloaks. When somebody died, the crypt was open. After many years, they found the unfortunate man wrapped in cloaks, which he pulled out of the coffins. And with his white beard reaching to the ground, he was utterly blind by now, but is still alive. And is still hoping and praying. He was taken out. He lived at least 10 years more. Man clings to life. Even if when to live is worse than death. Just think of this man eating insects. Living with dead, they smell. You think of that crypt. Hundreds of dead bodies around. Just licking drops of moisture from the walls. And waiting and praying for somebody to die. He went blind. Years and years in that darkness, but is still hoping to live. Such is the desire for life, such is the lust for life. And to be with a master, one has to be ready to die. Not physically, metaphorically. But even the idea of death makes people run away. But to be in contact with a master, you have to slowly, slowly disappear, metaphysically disappear. the ego has to die. Jesus says, until you are reborn. But how can you be reborn if you don't die? Rebirth has to be preceded by death. And the death has to be deeper than the bodily death. Because the bodily death is not much of a death. Soon you are born again, here you die. And within moments you have entered into another womb somewhere else. There is not even a gap. One body you lose, another body you immediately gain. But to die in the presence of a master is to really die. It is real suicide. The ego disappears forever. That is the meaning of surrender. It is difficult. The disciple comes, he bows down also. But that bowing is false. He says, I am at your disposal. But that is empty gesture. After an hour's lecture on duty to king and country, putting others before self and so on, the education corps captain pointed to one private and said, right, you, why should a soldier be prepared to die for his country? The soldier scratched his head for a minute, then grinned and said, you are quite right, sir, why should he? Just to think of death frightens. Don't laugh at those people who escaped from Jusia. Jusia was death. A master is death. That's how ancient scriptures say. A master is a death. Those people escaped. The children were innocent. They were not afraid because they didn't know what it is to look into the eyes of a master. People avoid looking into the eyes of the master. They avoid getting too much close, because to be too close is to melt, is to disappear, never to be same again. Remember these things. The story. A Sufi teacher was visited by a number of people of various faiths who said to him, accept us as your disciples, for we see that there is truth in our religions, and we are certain that what you are teaching is the one true path. Let us go into each important word in the story. A Sufi teacher was visited by a number of people of various faiths who said to him, a Sufi master is not there to destroy our religion, but to fulfill it. If he destroys anything, that means it is not religion, that's why he destroys it. If it is religion, he supports it. He enhances it. He is not against any path. All paths are God's paths. So if he finds somebody is following a path, he gives all his support. He will not take you astray from the path that you have been following. He will strengthen it. A Sufi master is not a missionary. He is not interested in converting people from one religion to another. He is interested certainly in converting people from irreligion to religion. But not from Christianity to Mohammedanism, or from Mohammedanism to Buddhism, or from Buddhism to Hinduism. A Sufi is not interested in changing people's identities, superficial identities. It never makes much difference. I have seen many Hindus who have become Christians. They remain the same. Nothing ever changes. It can't change because their conditioning. I used to live with a friend whose father was converted to Christianity. But they still think themselves Brahmins. Untouchables are not allowed in his family. They are Christian Brahmins, but Brahmins they are. The whole thing continues. I have seen Christians becoming Hindus. It makes no difference. I have heard about Mullah Nasruddin, who became an atheist in his old age. And one day he was trying to convert somebody to his atheism and was very loud. And finally, he said, "There is no God and Muhammad is his only prophet." It is very difficult. You can become an atheist, but if you have been a Mohammedan, deep down you remain a Mohammedan. Muhammad is the only prophet. I have heard about another atheist who was dying. And he said, "Thank God that there is no God." It is very difficult to get out of your conditionings. A Sufi master is not interested in changing your rituals, but he is certainly interested in giving you more and more religious quality. It is not a question of form, it is a question of quality. Whether you go to the mosque or to the temple does not matter. The real thing is prayer. Where you pray is immaterial. Just remember always, this is the Sufi approach. Where you pray is immaterial. Prayer matters. To whom you bow down is immaterial. Bowing down matters. To whom you surrender has no meaning. But that you have surrendered is of immense importance. Surrender has importance and relevance. The object of surrender is just an excuse. You can go to one master A and surrender, or to master B and surrender, or to master C and surrender. It makes no difference. If you are surrendered, you have started moving towards God. The master is just an excuse. Any master will do. So whatsoever is your liking, whosoever is of your liking, wherever you feel surrender is easier, surrender. The Sufi helps you how to surrender, how to pray. It does not matter whether you pray in Arabic or in Sanskrit or in Hebrew. But what you say in your prayer matters. I have heard, after 5-year-old Matt gave a loud whistle in the middle of the minister's sermon, his grandmother launched into a scolding. "Why on earth would you do such a thing?" she demanded. I have been praying for a long time that God would teach me to whistle. He explained, and this morning he did. A child's prayer is a child's prayer. What he can ask, he is asking God to give him the capacity to whistle. Just look at people's prayer, what they are asking, and you will find all childish. Somebody is asking for money, which is nothing but a capacity to whistle. So everybody can see who is whistling more loudly, more sharply, so you can defeat other whistlers. That's what money is all about. So you can whistle. Somebody is praying to be made a prime minister or a president. That is again the same. Asking to give the capacity to whistle so loudly that the whole country, the whole world listens. All are asking for the ego. For some importance, for some superiority. All are wanting to defeat others. All are competitors. And how can you pray if your mind is full of competition, jealousy? How can you pray if your mind is not full of love? The real prayer does not ask for anything. The real prayer is a thanking. It simply gives thankfulness to God for all that he has already given. There is no complaint in it. A minister is one who helps you for the essential religion. And the essential religion is one. Hinduism, Christianity, Jainism, Buddhism, Judaism. These are forms. Forms of different rituals. These are different languages. But the message is one. A Sufi teacher was visited by a number of people of various faiths who said to him, accept us as your disciples. For we see that there is no remaining truth in our religions. Now these people have been followers of somebody else. When you go to a Sufi master, he will not accept you so easily. Because you have been a follower of somebody else, what you have been doing there, if you have missed that master, you will miss this too. What is the point of changing? Maybe you will feel for a few days again on a kind of honeymoon, a new love affair. But if the old love affair is finished, this too will be finished sooner or later. It may give you a little thrill and sensation. You may start dreaming and hoping again, but nothing is going to happen, not essentially. Because you will go on doing the same that you have done with your old masters. Unless you change. Unless you understand that there is something lacking in you. Not in the master, but in you. Unless you take the responsibility that I have been missing, it is no point accepting disciples. Sufis won't accept. But if a disciple comes who has done all that he could do, their doors are open. I would like you to be reminded of Gautam Buddha. He went to many masters in his search. That's how a disciple should be. And he surrendered to many masters. And he surrendered totally. He was not holding back. whatsoever the master with whom he was at that time will say, he will do it totally. It is said that his masters will say finally to him that we are sorry. In fact, we have also not attained it. We are pretenders. You have exposed us. We cannot deceive you. We don't know a thing. Our deception goes on because people who come to us never listen to what we say. They never do it. So we are never exposed. You are the first person who has done whatsoever we say, and now we are feeling sorry for you. Excuse us. Forgive us. That's what the masters said. They were not masters. But Buddha's sincerity, his honesty, provoked even those deceivers to feel sorry. He worked so hard. And sometimes their demands were stupid. For example, one master, so-called master, said to him that go on reducing your food till you are taking only one grain of rice. Go on reducing it slowly, slowly. He did that. He became just bones. All flesh disappeared. Just a skeleton he was. The master must have felt. He was saying this to many people, but nobody has ever followed. So there was no problem. But this man, his sincerity, his utter devotion, his trust, when there is so much trust, even the people who exploit trust cannot exploit such trust. It is said he fell in Buddha's feet and he said, excuse me. Please forgive me. I have sinned against you and against God. I have committed a crime. I had never thought that anybody is going to follow what I say. And I have been making such strange demands that nobody will follow. And when nobody will follow, there is no question of being exposed ever. That's why your so-called masters go on demanding the impossible from you. They will say, repress sex and don't ever think of any beautiful woman, not even in your dreams. Now, first they say, repress sex. If you repress, your dreams will become full of sexuality. And then they say, even to dream about sex is a sin. You will never attain to God. If you follow them, you will be in difficulty. But nobody follows. And when people don't follow, they feel guilty that we have not been following the master. Out of their guilt, they touch his feet. Out of their guilt, they go on following him. Buddha went from one master to another. For 6 years he traveled all around the country. And it all sincerity was such that each master told him, please, you forgive us and you go and search somewhere else. Although he searched long and went to many people, but he never left the master till the master himself said to him that now you leave me. It is becoming unbearable. You go on doing whatsoever I say and nothing is happening, because what I am saying is absolutely fabricated guesswork. I have not known myself. This is the way of a disciple. If such a disciple comes to a Sufi master, he will welcome. He will embrace him to his heart. He will take him to his innermost bosom. But these people were not like that. They said to the master, accept us as your disciples, for we see that there is no remaining truth in our religions. How can you see? You are so blind. How can you see that there is no truth in your religions? This assertion is egoistic. A real seeker will say, maybe there is, but I am blind. I cannot see it. Give me eyes. Help me to see. A real seeker will say, not that there is no truth in religions, but I have not been able to see it. It must be my fault. He will take all responsibility on his own shoulders. To throw the responsibility on somebody else is an old ego trick. Beware of it. It never wants to take the responsibility on itself. It always goes on complaining about others. If you are not achieving, then something is wrong somewhere, but not that you are wrong. If you go on following whatsoever you are doing, if you do it sincerely, and then you come to know that you have done as humanly possible and nothing has happened, then it is time to move. A Sufi master accepts only those who move in such a way. But these people were saying, accept us as your disciples, for we see that there is no remaining truth in our religions, and we are certain. Now only stupid people can be certain about mysteries. Wise people will be hesitant. Intelligent people will not be so certain, cannot be. How can you be certain? And they said, and we are certain that what you are teaching is the one true path. And this they must have said to other teachers too. Mulla Nasruddin was in love with a woman. One full moon night, sitting on the beach, he told the woman that you are the most beautiful woman in the world. Never there has been any woman so beautiful, never will there be ever. The woman was thrilled. Her ego swelled up. And Mullah looked at her. She was a transformed being. And Mullah said, sorry, excuse me. But let me remind you one thing. This thing I have been telling to many women before. And I cannot promise you that I will not say to other women again. You are not the only one that I am saying this. This I say to every woman. This has been my usual practice. These people who are saying this, Master, that you are the only true path, must have said to others too. Their words have no meaning, no significance. They have been used again and again. They are really saying that we are so intelligent that we can see where is truth, who is true, who is really a perfect master. We are so intelligent that we know that you are the only true path. They are not saying anything about the master or the truth or the true path. They are simply saying in an indirect way that we are so intelligent that we can understand who you are. But you cannot deceive a master. Whatsoever you say, he will see through it. To encounter a master is to encounter a mirror. You cannot bribe a master. You cannot, because he has no ego, you cannot buttress him. Now this was something great they were saying. It is almost as you say to a woman that you are the most beautiful woman in the world. When you say to a religious teacher that you are the true path, it is almost the same. That's what the so-called teachers go on hankering for. They wait somebody to say it. If the master was a bogus one, he would have cherished these disciples. He would have declared to his other disciples, look, these are the real people I have been waiting for. These are the people who understand me. But because a master has no ego, he has not any self left. Sufis call it fana. He has disappeared. A master is really a true absence, a nothingness. He reflects the disciple. There is no way to provoke his ego, because there is none. The Sufi said, have you not heard of the Mongol Halaku Khan and his invasion of Syria? Let me tell you. The Wazir Ahmad of the Khalif Mustasim of Baghdad invited the Mongol to invade his master's domains. When Halaku had won the battle for Baghdad, Ahmad went out to meet him, to be rewarded. Halaku said, do you seek your recompense? And the wazir answered, yes. Halaku told him, you have betrayed your own master to me, and yet you expect me to believe that you will be faithful to me? He ordered that Ahmad should be hanged. A strange story to tell to those people who are declaring that you are the true path, that you are the true master. But a master has to say the truth as it is. He has to be absolutely frank. He cannot afford politeness. If it has to be hard, then it has to be hard. If it hurts, so it hurts. The master has to say it as it is. Now he is saying, you have betrayed your old masters, and you come to me. How can I trust you that you will not betray me? You have not followed your old masters, because I can see that you are carrying junk. If you have followed any master, you would have become unburdened of the junk. I can see the garbage of your knowledge. If you had followed any master, then the first thing is to drop knowledgeability. You have so much of knowledge, and because of that knowledge you are saying what is true and what is not true, and what religion to follow and what not to follow, and what is the right path and what is not the right path. It is according to your knowledge. You are so full of this bullshit. How can I think that you have followed any master, that you have been a disciple to anybody? You have never been a disciple. That much is certain. Whether those masters were true or not, that is not your business. One thing is certain, and that is your business, that you have not been disciples at all. And the same you are going to me too. How can I accept you? For what I should accept you? Just to be betrayed again? There is a Sufi story. A man was in love with a woman. So much so that he was ready to do anything. And the woman was demanding, very demanding. Finally she said that there is only one condition more to be fulfilled. Only then I will be yours. You are too much attached to your mother, unless you kill her and you bring her heart in a plate as a present to me, I cannot be yours. This is my last condition. He has fulfilled many conditions. He rushed home. He killed the mother. He took out her heart. And when he was coming back, he was in such a hurry. He was in such a passionate blindness that he stumbled on the way. The plate fell and broke. And the heart also fell and broke in many pieces. But from those many pieces, only one voice came. My son, walk a little more consciously. He gathered the pieces. He was not in any mood to listen to it. He gathered the pieces. He rushed to the woman. He offered the heart. The woman looked at it. She was aghast. She said, it is finished. If you can kill your own mother, I cannot trust you. You can kill me for any other woman. You are a dangerous man. You simply get out of my house. Never come back again. The relationship is completely finished. If you had said no, I would have been yours, but you missed. The story is the same, with the same flavor, and the same meaning, and the same message. If you can betray your old masters so easily, and can condemn them so easily, how the Sufi can trust you? You will do the same to him. Do you see the point? If a man who is a Hindu and becomes easily a Christian, the Christian missionary is simply deceiving himself. Because if he was not a true Hindu, and he could deceive, how he can be a true Christian? And a true Christian and a true Hindu are the same. The difference is only between the untrue Christian and the untrue Hindu. Truth is one. And the true path is one. It does not belong to anybody. It is nobody's property. It is not my path and Buddha's path and Krishna's path and Zarathustra's path. It is just the path. Buddha, Zarathustra, Laozi, they have all walked on it. It is only one. There are not many paths really. Many people walk on the path, but the path is one. And it is so vast that they may not even meet each other. The demand of the Sufi master is very significant. You have to understand it. He says, you have betrayed your own master. you can betray me too. And I don't want to do anything with people like such. You go back. And he says this story. The Wazir Ahmad of Khalif Mustasim of Baghdad invited the Mongol to invade his master's domains. He betrayed his master. And now he wants to be rewarded. Halaku Khan did well with him. This is the reward. He ordered that Ahmad should be hanged. This man is not trustworthy. He has betrayed his master, who has trusted him for so long, maybe for years. How can I trust this man? I cannot leave him alone. He is dangerous. He can do the same to me and more easily, because I am a stranger. He was not even true to his master, who was not a stranger, who had taken him so close to himself that he could betray and help me to destroy his master. And now he has come to be rewarded. This man is a traitor. The Sufi said, before you ask anyone to accept you, ask yourself whether it is not simply because you have not followed the path of your own teacher. If you are satisfied about this, then come and ask to become disciples. Not that he is saying, I will not accept you, but he makes a simple condition. Have you followed your old master? Have you done what he was telling you to do? Have you practiced it in any way? If you have practiced, if you have done it, if you are certain about it, that you did it and it didn't work, you did all that you could and it didn't work, you were not hearted in it, you were not holding back, you were not clever and cunning, you were not just an spectator, but you had participated in the being of the master. If you can be certain about this, if you are satisfied with your performance as a disciple, then come to me. I will accept you. But that is something very important. This is happening nowadays very much in the world. People go on moving from one master to another, like driftwood. They knock on many doors, but they never knock long enough, so the door doesn't open. They have no patience. They don't do a thing. They are simply rushing here and there, as if somebody else is going to give them the truth. Truth is not a thing to be given. It cannot be transferred. You have to earn it. You have to become pregnant with it. It has to be born in you. You have to become a womb for it. It is something alive. You have to pour your life energies into it. You have to revive it within your being. You have to create it. God is not there sitting somewhere, so you go and discover. God has to be created. So those who are looking for God as if he is hiding somewhere and they will go and search and find him, are looking in vain. You are not only to discover gods, you have to create him. Each prayerful heart creates God again and again. It is your creation. But people go on thinking of God as if it is something like a commodity. You can purchase it. A man came to Mahavira, a king. His name was Prasenjit, a very famous king of those days. And he was masters. He had been to Buddha. He had been to Ajit K. Skambali. He has been to Prakuddha Katyayana. He has been to Makhali Gosal. He has been to Sanjay Belathiput. To many teachers. Then he came to Mahavira. And he asked Mahavira that give me what you call meditation, dhyana. Give it to me. And I am ready to pay for it, whatsoever the price. A worldly man only knows how to purchase a thing. Thinks of everything as if it can be purchased. If he falls in love with a woman, he purchases the woman and misses thereby. Because love cannot be purchased. You can purchase the body, but not the soul. Love has to be earned. You have to become worthy for it. Now he comes to Mahavira and asks such a stupid question. Mahavira must have laughed. He said, listen, why you trouble to come so far into this forest? In your own capital there is a man, my disciple he is, a very poor man, and he will very much like to sell his meditation. He is so poor. You just go to him. I don't need what you can give to me. So I am not in any mood to sell my meditation to you. You go and purchase a very poor man. He may decide to sell it. It was a joke. Prasenjit rushed in his chariot, went to the poor man's hut. It was such a poor hut that he thought, certainly this man will sell. I can purchase even this man. What about the meditation? And the man came. Very poor man, almost naked, but utterly beautiful and graceful. A great light within his being. You can see it. And the king felt that Mahavira is right. This man has got it. Look at his face, so luminous. And he said, just tell me, what do you want? I have come to purchase your meditation, your samadhi. And I am ready to give anything you ask. The man hesitated what to say to the king. And the king thought, obviously, that he is hesitating about the price. So he said, don't be worried. You say any amount. But the man said, it is not a question of price. The king said, you don't be worried about it at all. I can give my whole kingdom to. Because when once I decide to purchase a thing, I always purchase it. You just say. But the man said, I'm sorry to say. I don't want to say no to you. But what you are asking, it is absurd. I cannot sell it. It is not a thing. It is not anything objective. It has happened to me. Mahavira must have played a joke with you. You go back to the master. He had sent you simply here so that you can understand that even if you give your kingdom to a poor beggar, he cannot sell his meditation or samadhi. There is no way to purchase it. It is invaluable, and it is not a commodity at all. But people go on thinking God is a commodity, samadhi is a commodity, enlightenment is a commodity, give us. It is not. You have to become it. You have to be transformed. And only your effort can transform you. The master can show you the way, but you will have to follow. The Sufi said, before you ask anyone to accept you, ask yourself whether it is not simply because you have not followed the path of your own teacher that you have missed, and you are not ready to say that you are not a disciple, that you have not been a disciple. Instead, you are saying that the master is wrong. Instead of saying that I have not followed the path, you are declaring that the path is wrong and there is no more truth on it. If you are satisfied about this, that you have done all that you could and more is not possible for you, and nothing has happened there, then come to me. Then I am ready to help you. But be satisfied about that. This has to be understood by every disciple, every seeker. You are with me here. If you don't go into that space that I make available for you, sooner or later you will start thinking nothing is happening. What I am doing here, I must go and seek some other door. I must go and beg somebody else. I must go and learn from someone, somewhere else. But the space is available to you. The door is open. And you are not walking in. You remain hanging outside. You go on pretending in 1001 ways that you are moving, but you are not moving. The movement is possible only when you are totally with me. Even if a small part of you moving, but you are not moving. The movement is possible only when you are totally with me. Even if a small part of you is not with me, it is impossible to move in the door. You will have to move as a total organic unity. You cannot leave your left hand outside. You cannot leave anything outside. You will have to move totally in. Only then you can move. You cannot move partially in. Remember it. So those who are totally with me, they have moved. And those who are going to be totally with me, they will move. But many will be there also who will simply be here partially, a little bit, trying to judge whether it is worth taking the risk, hanging around, calculating. If you are calculating, you are not a disciple. If you are trying to figure it out, you are not a disciple. Because it is not a question of figuring it out. It is so immense, you cannot figure it out. It is so enormous, You cannot calculate about it. It is bigger than you. So you cannot hold it in your hands. You have to be ready to disappear, to evaporate. You have to die, and only then the resurrection. The disciple has to become the mythological bird, phoenix. He has to disappear into the fire, and out of the ashes the new will be born. Those who are ready, those who can take the risk, those who are courageous, only they will attain. And the remaining ones will start thinking, maybe this is not the right door, this is not the right path, this is not the right master, I should go somewhere else, why I am wasting my time here? And you will do the same somewhere else too. And you can go on and on, life after life, wandering and wandering and never arriving. This is how you have been doing in your past lives. You are not new. Nobody is new. All are old timers. You have been here forever and ever. From the very beginning you have been here. I know here are people who have been with Buddha and missed. I know here are people who have been with Rumi and missed. And I know there are many people who have been with Jesus and missed. It is not new that you are for the first time with a master. You have been many times. And each time you missed, you condemned the master rather than rethinking about your own self. The calculating people are always ready to listen about the truth, but it has to be abstract. When you come to the details, when they have to do something, when the truth starts becoming pragmatic reality, then problems arise. There is a famous statement of Ludwig Wittgenstein: don't look for the meaning, look for the use. And in a similar way, thousands of years before Wittgenstein, Lao Tzu says, the meaning is the use. The use is the meaning. When you look for it, you cannot see it. When you listen for it, you cannot hear it. But when you use it, it is inexhaustible. A master is not there to give you a doctrine, but a discipline. A doctrine is an abstract thing. It is about God. A discipline is not about God. It is about you. A master is not there to philosophize, because we have more philosophy than we need. Already too much. A master is there to help you walk. You are cripples. A master is there to heal, to cure you, your crippledness, your blindness, your paralysis. He is a physician. He is not a philosopher. But people are always ready to listen to abstract things, because those abstract things never touch your life. I have heard. This story comes from the heart of China. In a small church in a remote village, the people came to the minister complaining that the wife of a deacon was stealing chickens from her neighbor. And they said, "You have got to do something about it." He said, "All right, I will." That Sunday he preached on the text, "You shall not steal." At the close of the service, the deacon came to him and said, "Excellent sermon, pastor." But in 3 or 4 days, the people came and said, "That sermon didn't do any good at all. She is still stealing." So the next Sunday, the minister got more specific. He said, "You shall not steal your neighbor's goods." At the close of the service, the deacon shook hands and said, "That's a much better sermon. You have really got to speak specifically." However, during the week, the people said that didn't do any good. They are still stealing. So the minister took courage in both hands and said, "You shall not steal your neighbor's chickens." The deacon came to him and said, "Now, look, you are not supposed to be all that specific in the pulpit. When it comes to the small, real details of your life, you stop hearing. When it is about abstract worlds of paradise, God, Nirvana, you are all alert. It doesn't matter. It is beautiful philosophy. You cannot lose anything. You can become a little more knowledgeable. But when it comes to the stealing of your neighbor's chickens, then it touches your life. There you become alert. There you stop listening. Remember, a master is not to impart abstract truths to you, but something that has to be practiced in life. Something that has to become your lifestyle. Great courage is needed, and great endeavors, and great discipline to change and transform one's way of life. If you cannot, don't condemn the path you have been following, because really you have never followed it. A man went up to the salesman at the Rolls-Royce stand in the motor company's show and asked the way to the gents' toilet. The route was a bit complicated, and the salesman deserted his post to escort the man to the door of the toilet. Thanking him, the man asked why he had gone to so much trouble. "Because," answered the salesman, "yours was the first genuine inquiry I have had all day." If you really want to be with a master, you will have to become a genuine inquiry, not philosophic curiosity, but an inquiry in which your life and death are involved. An inquiry which is going to transmute you. An inquiry that is going to become a metamorphosis. You are capable of flying into the sky, but you are hiding in your cocoon. Those cocoons have to be broken, and it hurts. And it hurts because you think those cocoons are your defense, your safety. Because you think those cocoons are your homes. They are your prison cells. The master has to destroy the prison cells so the prisoner can be freed. But the prisoner has become too much identified with the prison cell. So he decorates it. He may even hang the picture of the master in the prison cell. He may worship the master, but in the prison cell. But he will not listen to the master that the prison cell has to be broken. And unless you destroy the prison cell and cooperate with the master in destroying it, you will not be free. And to be free is the only way to know what truth is. Freedom is truth. Freedom is God. Freedom is Nirvana. Enough for today.